My name is John Beck, and I have the honor of and pleasure of co-directing our Daily Work of Daily Lives. And this is the 19th year of our Brown Bag series. You know, it's like, where did the time go? Obviously, I started the Brown Bag series when I was 13 and only in junior high, but that's also not true. Today's presentation is co-sponsored by three organizations here on campus. MSU's a wonderful Women's Resource Center, which is led by our great colleague, Jane Skederman. MSU's African American and African Studies program, which recently moved from Morrill Hall when it was torn down to Wells Hall. I found them the other day when I was wandering on campus. And the MSU Center for Gender in Global Context. And it's really wonderful that we have great co-sponsors like them, so I'll just quickly pass around Jane's newsletter for any of you who don't get a copy. Everyone wants a copy. And then we have a brown bag next Monday that's going to be co-sponsored by the School of Journalism here on campus. Carol Quirk is coming in also from New York State, so this is our New York State week, obviously, from SUNY Old Westbury, where she's in the American Studies Department. Carol has looked at issues of how labor is covered in the media, specifically historically. So she's going to be talking on Monday on her research. It's called Bitter Kisses for Labor, Mass Consumer Capitalism and the Hershey Chocolate Sit-Down Strike of 1937. Naturally, here in Michigan, we're all really caught up in the history of the Flint sit-down strike. Who knew that there was a chocolate sit-down strike, you know? The nice thing is that means if you take over the factory, you have things to eat while you're on strike. And if you would just hand those to Jane and those can come around. Please do sign in on those sign-in sheets and do circulate those if you would. Last but not least is the copy of our fall. I'll just hand that to Rick, and you can just hand, you don't have to hand them out, you can just hand them to, and those can go around the room. The rest of our Brown Bag series, I have to tell you that I'm very upset because the fact that our earlier speaker, who was coming back in October, Heather Pristash, can't come now. And she does the most interesting work on protest knitting that anyone has ever seen in the world. So we will be rescheduling Heather at another time. She is unable to come to Michigan at that time from Wyoming. So we're happy to know that we're going to be rescheduling her. So today, and let me mention that all of our brown bags this fall are covered under the Project 6050 here on campus. And so we're very proud to be part of that effort as well. Today, I'm very happy to have Dr. Catherine Silva join us from the History Department at Utica College. Catherine grew up in the East, and much of what she's going to talk about today actually is in her own backyard back in Massachusetts. She attended UMass Boston and then went on to the University of South Carolina for her master's and her doctorate. So today, she's going to be talking on the topic, Redefining Skilled Mill Labor, Cape Verdean and African-American Women in the American Textile Industry, 1900 through 1930. So please join me in welcoming Catherine Silva.
Thank you for having me today. I've been looking forward to coming here. I actually just finished teaching at Andrews University this past summer. I've been there for 4 years, so it's nice to be back in Michigan for just a little bit, even if it's just for a couple days. Yes?
I'm having a little trouble understanding you.
Yeah, here.
Okay.
Like
all right. So, can you hear me now? Is it better? Okay, great. And if you can't, if I also speak quickly, so you can tell me to slow down a bit. But thank you for having me today. Today I really want to talk about skilled mill labor and our definition of skill when it comes to textile industry. And this is really taken out of my larger work that I did for my dissertation, and now I'm working on my book manuscript entitled At Times We May Seem Bold, African American Women in the Southern Textile Industry. The first part of my talk will cover ideas of labor and a kind of an overview and a historical overview of skilled labor in this period. Then I'll go on to talk about black women's labor in North Carolina, in particular the Fayetteville and Durham hosiery mills that hired African Americans as skilled laborers in the early part of the 1900s, all the way through for Durham hosiery mills to the 1950s. Then I'll talk a little bit about Cape Verdeans and the inclusion of African women in the industry in New Bedford. It's a smaller portion because it's the part of the work I'm really working on right now, but I wanted to talk about how ethnicity also plays into this as we go forward. And it's a little bit of an analytical assessment, and of course, conclude it with lots of questions as we go forward. This is a work in progress, so I always welcome lots of questions to help me think about how I continue to formulate the manuscripts. So thank you. So how I started with this topic was really in 2004 or 5, in the beginning of my graduate career. I was really fortunate enough to work with Val Littlefield out of the University of South Carolina. And she handed me this auction brochure that was of the Ashley and Bailey Silk Mill. They were auctioning off a whole bunch of their mills, including the ones that are in Paterson, New Jersey, and elsewhere, including a mill in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And in the brochure, it's outlined its building of a school and their workers being African American women, which was interesting to me because at that point, for all my study, I've never heard of African American workers being in the textile industry. Maybe as custodial help, but never as the main employees for the entire mill. And so my advisor was much more interested in teachers, which is the work she does, but I was really much more interested in factory work. Coming from southeastern Massachusetts and having a mom herself who was a factory worker, I thought, let's look into this. What does this mean? And by the way, my mother's also a Cape Verdean immigrant, so that's also where that comes from. And so I went forward and started looking at census records and realized that Fayetteville was not the only place that hired African Americans in their textile mills. But how it happened and how it progressed is a unique story that really talks about the Jim Crow industrial complex. Yes? It's not the only place, but it's one of the major centers for it as well. And so when I started thinking about this, I thought about the mill girl. Every time I mention textile industry, the first thing I get is, oh yeah, you know, Massachusetts Lowell mill girls. And everybody knows that history of young girls leaving their family farm to go work in the industry. This was a way of them moving outside of their parents' home. It's usually single girls, young, white. But this is really the early beginnings of the industry and does not really talk about African Americans' industry at all, and it's actually not the full picture of it. But that's usually the image you get and usually the question I get first when I talk about mill workers. The second image I get is of, this is a white man in the mill. This is from Durham, one of the Durham mills. It's always the idea of skilled mill labor having to be male, and it usually is considered white. So back in the early 1800s, you have skilled labor as being white women in the mills in the north or maybe in their homes. Later on in the 1900s, you have skilled mill labor being weavers, usually men, and that's how we always define mill work. And we also define the idea of skilled labor always being white male. And so my work starts to really kind of complicate that because these mills are also hiring African American women in the same positions they do, white men. And that's really what I'll be talking about mostly today. Now, most mill histories, and I'm just gonna pull this up and I'll come to this in just a moment, but most mill histories really talk about the industry as being white only. And there have been several seminal works that really been really important to the idea of what is labor in the South. One of those being Jacqueline Dowd Hall's Like a Family, which I will talk about. And so what I want to do today is think about the historical background of the mill industry, but then also go forward and talk about these particular case studies, as I said, and really start to dissect what does it mean to be a mill worker. Now, as we know, just to kind of go back and backtrack a little bit, one of the things that's important to know about North Carolina is that in this period that I'm talking about, really beginning in the 1900s, but even beforehand, African American women have very limited opportunities for labor outside of the textile industry, Right. So for even tobacco workers, really where they will end up in factories. So one of the things that we think about with black women in factories, we think of them doing the dirty work of stemming or other kind of tobacco work. Or we think about them in the homes of white employers, sometimes their former families that are associated with slavery and the families of those sons and daughters and grandchildren of their former families' owners. We think of that agricultural work as well. So sharecropping within the tobacco farms, also cotton industry in North Carolina. But we don't ever really think about them being in the mills. Now in South Carolina is where the first mills really started hiring African Americans, but they were short-lived. So for example, in 1896, Beaufort, South Carolina, hired a few African American women who were part of the industrial school nearby, and they tried to have skilled labor. They decided to do it in Beaufort because it was mostly black, and they would not be competing with the white workers who were from the Piedmont. They did this again in Columbia, South Carolina, in Charleston. But when they did it in Charleston, there was massive protests. There was actually a firing of all the white workforce, bringing in the black workers in 1901. And then the white workers themselves came back and beat up some of the African Americans who were now working in the mills or around the mill. And eventually the mill owner decided, John Montgomery, to forget the enterprise, let it go, and in 1904 left for Georgia. Again, they try again in Columbia, South Carolina. And all of these people knew each other. They were all related through either marriage or they're actually related through blood. Some of these mill owners, like the one in Columbia, South Carolina, was Modjeska Simpkins' white grandfather who tried to open up a mill with his black son and have a mill there with skilled workers. But in 1914, South Carolina decided that they were going to put in a law in place and say no black workers were allowed on the premises of textile mills at all. They were not allowed in the stairwells. They were not allowed to work there at all. And that was partly because of, again, ideas of race, but they were also worried about black men being in the mills. And that's one of the key points I want to point out right away. When I'm talking about African-American workers and skilled workers, I'm talking about women. They specifically, no matter where they were, whether it's in North Carolina or South Carolina, they were not talking about bringing in black men. Black men were too dangerous as far as they were concerned. They saw them as too close to white women, and the idea, again, this idea of rape and the excuse of rape was used quite often. But they also didn't want black men competing with white men in similar jobs. And so black men were almost wholly excluded from the textile industry, except for in jobs like custodial work or jobs like doing the dye work in the houses, the dye houses like for dungarees particularly, or moving bales of cotton. So it's always heavy industry outside of the mills themselves, never inside the mill building, or very rarely, and really quite pushed aside otherwise. But what all of these mills have in common, which I found over time, is that they want black women in the mills. They are actively seeking out African-American women to work as skilled, what they would say is skilled and semi-skilled workers. They're not looking for them to work as just custodial help, which is what we often have gotten in these histories. Now, Jacqueline Dowd-Hall's work, as I mentioned before, talks about the importance of the textile industry in the South. And it's important to remember that it starts to move away from the North, goes down south in the 1920s and 30s in particular, really has its heyday. And it's because now this is a new industry for white workers to actually move out of the agricultural work of farming and go into another industry. And the tobacco, like I said, was very dirty, so it gives you another opportunity to do something else. And so what you see is much more women, single women and children also moving into the industry as well, white women. You also see Brian Simon's work, who talks about the same thing. But also, white men see the cotton mill work as a way of reestablishing patriarchy, which again plays into the idea of skill. So you have skilled labor, which is white, it's male, that's how they define it, that's how they decide how much somebody's going to get paid. And now that I've been thinking about this work, it really seems to me that they just call it skilled, just to call it white male. It is synonymous. It is really not more skilled. It's just the way to describe the idea of skill. And so what you see over time in the industry here is really this discussion of what is skill and who should be a part of it. And my first case study is Ashley Bailey Silk Mill in Fayetteville, North Carolina. This is actually a really interesting piece, not just because it's the first one I started with, but it's also incredibly unique in a lot of ways. First of all, Ashley Bailey Silk Mill is actually owned by the Ashley and Bailey Company, which is Northern owned. They are descendants of Scottish and English immigrants, and they also own mills in Paterson, New Jersey, which were also involved in the 1911 silk strike, and you also see them own mills in places like Utica, which I didn't even realize until a couple days ago when I was going back through my files, and I had ignored the North a little bit in my dissertation, and so now I'm going back and looking at my research and realize the place I live now had one of the mills. So they had mills in the North, yes? Yeah, so one of the things I noticed about these mills is that they are also located in places like where I live now, Utica, New York. And they had 14 mills altogether. They're a northern-owned company. And what they decided to do in 1901 is to build another textile mill in the South, in Fayetteville, to be a plant specifically built for African-American workers. They situated, and I brought this because I wanted to show you, so this is the plant itself. They have dye houses here. There's another plant here. And this is taken in 1910. They decide that unlike the mills in the South that only mostly hire white workers, that they were specifically going to put this mill in the Ashley Heights neighborhood of Fayetteville, North Carolina. And the Ashley Heights neighborhood is all black neighborhood and situated next to where now Fayetteville State University is. It also had a school already in place, a colored normal school. And they wanted to hire only African-American workers at this time and say, we're going to pick black women who are highly, highly skilled, right, and educated. A lot of their workers, as we'll see with also Durham Hosiery Mill, went to college. And they also hired a woman by the name of Gertrude Hood, who was the daughter of James Walker Hood, who was a major figure in the AME Zion Church. He was a bishop. He's well-known, nationally known. Actually, Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois both knew him. And they hired her as one of the mill supervisors, and she was actually on one of the floors. She worked on one of the floors with a whole bunch of girls doing spinning work and looping. Above her was the weaving room where black women also labored, with young kids also doing like the smaller work with their hands, as you see in other mills with white-only workers. And that was led by a man who was from England, and there was another individual on another floor, also a white man, but he was also not American, he was Scottish. And so they specifically pick white men who are not from the area who are gonna work in these mills as supervisors, but only a few. The main supervisor of the textile mill was a black man by the name of Thomas Wellington Thurston. From all accounts, including his grandchildren who got in touch with me a few years ago, he's not a very nice person, kind of mean, but really well known to Booker T. Washington, good friends with him as well. And they decide in this bill that they were going to put in place black workers as skilled workers, which is also interesting in the fact that there's a Toller Hart company, a white-owned mill, in the same city at the same time, hiring only white workers. This does become problematic. In 1905, they accuse one of the mill workers, Walter Partridge, of rape of one of the white mill workers. He is put on trial and found guilty. The woman who from Toller Hart who accused him, Mary Holt, later on sent a letter to the governor before his execution, said, I lied, I was paid to do this, I was paid to lie about the rape. But the governor ignored it, the jury ignored it, well, the powers that be ignored it, the judges, and Partridge was killed in 1905. And that seems to be the last time you see any mention of African-American men in that mill, too. So if there were a few, except for Thurston, who seemed to go with the status quo in Fayetteville and did not say nice things about Partridge himself, was partly to save the mill itself and to make sure that they continue to have that kind of labor. So that's the first example of skilled mill labor. Now, I could go into more detail, but I want to talk about Durham, too. But the reason I bring this up is that, again, they're doing the exact same jobs as white workers in Tolar Hart or other places, but we don't consider them skilled. We don't talk about that. And they're also much more educated. Most mill workers only have an eighth grade or lower, sometimes even lower education. A lot of them never go to high school who are white. Black workers tend to be much more educated. Even in the census, they all can read and write. A lot of them went to high school. And as we'll see in Durham, they're also much more educated. Again, I went through the census records. I just wanted to pull it up just to show that although we never think about it, if you go back to the census record, it's very clear when you find silk mill workers. This is just one page of thousands I've gathered over the time to go through and find these people and find their names and who they were. I find it exciting, although some people may not, but I love it, just to kind of know more about these people. Now, the Durham Hosiery Mills is a, yes?
I just had a question about
sure.
That slide.
Okay.
Not
always. The helpful part of some of this does. Sometimes they'll say weaver or doffer or be very specific. The census records don't show as much of the details of the job, but the city directories do. And so I can go back, I've gone through the city directories to find out exactly what jobs they've had. And Gertrude Hood I knew because she's been mentioned by Booker T. Washington actually in some of his magazine, his articles. So she was specifically mentioned as being a skilled worker and look at this wonderful industry and look how we could have people like her in the mills. And this actually shows how we can continue to uplift the race and pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. So she was mentioned quite often and really well known. So great question. So you have the John O'Daniel Textile Mill, which is in Durham, North Carolina. Actually, the building is still standing today and it's actually on the National Register of Historic Places. The interesting thing about it being on the register, it's on the register as a dye house, and very, very, very brief mention of being a place where African-American workers were, right? And it's actually a really important story behind this. The Durham Hosiery Mills is actually quite a huge industrial complex. It actually has several mills, almost 15 across Durham in outlying areas. They built, just like Fayetteville, in the same period, textile mill, one particular building, for black workers, and then they continue to expand over time, calling them Colored Mill 1 or 2, and this one, John O'Daniel. It's built by the Carr family. Julian Carr was a Confederate general, met sons of Confederacy kind of guy. Also, parents were slave owners. And John O'Daniel is actually his half-brother, his half-black brother. And so just like in other mills that I saw, they would oftentimes help out one of their, help out, I'm putting that in quotes on purpose, their brother by owning or having, giving them a mill. And so John O'Daniel becomes one of the several mills within this complex that hires black women specifically to labor in skilled work. This one is where we can actually know much more about who they are. They actually have a company newsletter. For 2 years. And part of the reason why they have the company newsletter goes back to the ending of Fayetteville's experiment. Fayetteville closes in 1914, as I mentioned in the very beginning, with the auction brochure. But it closes because they no longer want to deal with unions. Again, they were involved in the 1911 silk mill strike in Paterson, New Jersey. And they said, you know, there's too much unionization coming down to the South. We want to forget that. So we're closing everything. And they close all of their plants. Well, Durham's solution to that was, let's use management style that our sons have learned at going to schools like Harvard and UNC, and we're going to put in industrial democracy, which is kind of a fake way of having some sort of company-led union. And they do this with also having a newsletter. And so when I was through the archives, and I'm looking through these 5,000 pieces over 6 weeks, the last thing I found was the company newsletter, which made me jump out of my seat in the middle of the archives at Duke University. I was so excited because it actually has people's names, and a lot of material from the people themselves, the workers themselves, are included in these. Now, Julian Carr, as I mentioned, does build the Durham textile mill for his half-brother, but he's not doing this because he's such a nice guy also, right? He also is incredibly racist, right? So he thinks that there are certain parts, certain people who are involved in the industry who should be there. He uses the word, he actually has a couple of speeches where he says that he is a friend to the Negro, and quote, "Nigger was the providence of God, created for social rather than political use." And he felt like it was okay to use all of these words, right? He also felt like black work was a launching of a movement, and he writes in one of his, well, says in one of his speeches, "The launching of a movement that is destined to bring peace and happiness to contented homes, and that will dispense with profitable employment to hundreds of industrious and worthy colored people, that not only this community be benefited, may its benefits be felt around the world in uplifting and upbuilding of our community." And so he's specifically choosing certain people to work in these mills. He picks African Americans who are well educated, and in the Durham textile mill, he picks individuals who also went to Livingston College or other colleges nearby to earn their education. So most of his workers actually have college degrees. Black workers, not his white workers. His white workers do not. And I'm going to note here that even within these pieces, most of the time that people are addressed, or African American women are addressed in these mills, they're addressed in the company newsletter as by their only first name. They never get Mrs. or Miss. If they're an older woman, they might get Auntie or something like that in there. These are edited by the personnel department, so I'm sure they were not submitted that way by the black mills, but they definitely ended up like that once they were in print. White mills, every person is introduced as Miss or Mrs. or Mister. There's a specific point to do that. But it's also interesting that they're talking about the work that's done in these mills, and if you look at the newsletter back and forth, you see that black women are doing the same work white women are doing in the mill. But their work is considered unskilled, or even the way we talk about it as historians is that black women were doing unskilled labor in the mill. But in fact, these letters say, no, in fact, they're doing skilled labor, and they're doing it at the same rate or even better rate. They have better attendance. The company is really noting that throughout the whole piece. But you also have women in there who are also making their own voices known. And one of my favorite people, and I do have favorites, I shouldn't probably, but I do, is Luda Bell Williams Ward, who lives to be about 101 years old, which she passed away just a few years before I actually started this project, so I was really sad to hear that. And she was never interviewed. None of these workers, by the way, were ever interviewed. I don't have any oral histories from them. I've looked and looked and looked. So even though there's been massive oral histories of textile workers and they're in the census from Durham, they were never approached at any point. And so she writes a poem in one of the newsletters that really talks about what's it like for a black worker in the mill. So we may not have the oral history, but we have some poetry. And she writes, I'm gonna wait for the bell for a second. All right, hopefully you can hear me. "When the boss gets you told on the Scott and Williams line, don't fret and declare the fault wasn't mine. It makes one feel awful blue when he's tried hard to be true, resolved to do his best, trying hard to stand the test. Then up comes the boss, gee whiz, he's cross. He halts to fix the machine wreck and wonders what's coming next. He halts before you and proceeds to take his test. Here, an armful of your work, which is not correct. These socks are absolutely too tight. You must keep this work right. Knit these socks for great big feet. Make them comfortable and neat. Then he looks at you as if to say, oh, you lazy scout, I have found you out. You are a good-for-nothing skunk. You are not worthy of a decent bunk. Then one feels distinguished, because the boss thinks he can't be trust. It is then one begins to realize everything can't be peaches and pies." She goes on to write similar poetry throughout the piece, and as does a few other women within the mills. And a couple of things stood out to me as I was looking at these pieces and these poems, is that we don't have these words ever told to us that black women were thinking these things within the factory work. They're choosing this work for a lot of reasons. And a lot of it's just to move outside of the family home, outside of the domestic work of a family home, a white family home. It's also to move out of the tobacco industry, especially in North Carolina. But it's also to do work that is new. And sometimes we think about the idea of integration having to be massive. So when we talk about the Southern textile industry as being integrated in the 1970s with thousands of people, at this point it's only a few hundred. But there's plenty of times where black women are the only one in the room, right? But that doesn't make their inclusion not important. And when you have 500 women in the Durham hosiery mills, which is what total was about over 50 years, they continue to hire them. Doing the same work as white mill workers, talking about how they're being watched by their supervisor, talking about how they have to have perfect attendance, how they have to have perfect work, makes you realize what is it like to be one of those few who are able to break into that industry and have to keep confronting Jim Crow and the industrial complex over time in order for it to later on break, right? It's not just because the industry changes and shifts and that people find other jobs outside textiles and black women can just come in. It's because they've been working for decades for this to happen. And so those small moments are incredibly important, but we oftentimes leave out because they're not a big story. And so my point is that I want to tell those smaller stories so we can understand the larger picture of what Jim Crow really looks like. She's not the only one, Luda Bell Williams Ward. There are other black women who are also labor in the mill. This is the Durham Textile Mill, and this is the only photograph I've ever been able to find, so I hope it's the cover of a book or something. I love it so much. But I think that what's going on within these mills is that you're hiring black women not just as mill workers, but also as nurses. They also hire them as skilled labor overall. Now, as I mentioned, in this piece that you have these mill workers who are attending school. In fact, their college president from Livingston College, W.S. Foster, and Professor Suggs, both come to visit the mill. W.E.B. Du Bois visits this mill, and Booker T. Washington, before he passes, also makes mention of this mill. And so it's interesting of all the people who don't usually get along, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, both said that this is a city of Negro enterprises and a wonderful example of what black workers can do, right? So you have this one time, well, maybe not one time, but one of the few times that they actually agree with one another that this is a great thing. You have college-educated women who are actually having the ability to come into these mills, to work in a new industry, to break the color line. They don't know how long that's going to take, so to them, this is always new, right? This is always innovative. And this photograph clearly staged with a little band in the back, which I think is pretty great. So if you look right here, you have a band that's playing. And it's celebrating this idea that, yes, you can get into this kind of work. Now, you have, as I said, this industry continues over time. And one of the important points I want to make is that while some of the educated mill employees earn income as factory workers, also held positions as in which they were trained. For example, the company decided to hire nurses for each of its buildings, and this included hiring of African-American nurses for its black employees. Pearl Henderson was a nurse for African-Americans in the Durham Colored Mill No. 2. As they continued over time, Durham Hosiery Mill continued to add more and more colored mills within their industrial complex. She actually attended the Colored Nurses Association convention in Boston, Massachusetts in August of 1919. And she reported in a newsletter that she had, quote, a fine trip and gained new ideas, especially regards to reforming to improve the life of colored people. Over time, you see the company institute company-wide healthcare policies for all of their employees, including all of those in the mill, including black workers. So they did include them in that. But they did not include them in any of the mill teams, the baseball teams, anything like that you did not see over time. Now, you also have other workers who are in here. I just want to talk about them for a little bit. Annie White worked on machines, as she said, from morning till night. And you have other workers who are working in the doffing industry. You have the industrial the supervisor is white within the Durham Hosiery Mills, and he talks about how you have African Americans who are also retaliating a little bit against each other. You have black men who are not as open with one another, with black women who are working the mill, and there seems to be a lot of difficulty between one group versus another. So you see black men who are working as dyers and workers who feel that black women are complaining too much, like Ludabelle Williams Ward. And one of those individuals is L.L. Edwards, who says that he doesn't know why black women need to complain. We have it fine. It's fine the way things are. Don't complain. Don't rock the boat. But I think, again, this has a lot to do with the idea of who's doing skilled work and also the idea of gender within this. So black men are very much more a target. They can't complain. They're much more likely to be lynched. They're much more likely to be the victims of retaliation. Not that black women are not, but it's a different thing. And I think here you have a community who's having difficulties dealing with gender between its two workers. How does one negotiate the mill itself when you have black men working outside and black women working inside in very different jobs, but also both wanting to sustain those jobs and continue them over time? Whose needs are most benefited? It's interesting as you read through these newsletters that you see the more and more tensions grow up over time, including one particular woman, Ardonia Norwood, who writes about the machines and working the machines. She writes, "We are the girls of the Georgian line, trying to do our work nice and fine. When we are at work, no time to play. That is when we are happy and gay. One Friday morning, about 9:30, William H. Hunter put up a sign. From what a shout rose from the George D. hands, for Mr. T.H. Johnson is our foreman. We George D. girls are not hard to control, though at times we may seem a little bold. When we have no work and out of place, our boss is mad. Look at his face. We are proud of the George D. line, and we do our best to go by the time. To go by the times means to do our work right, which means we'll try to do without all our might." And again, using doublespeak, employees were able to express their frustrations without complete fear of reprisals from their employers. In many ways, the written word allowed men and women to express their discontent with unfair work practices and the difficulties of industrial work. The women of the Scott and Williams line of Mill No. 2 used poetry to express their frustrations and hardships experienced in the mill. And Ludabelle Williams Ward, as I said, with William Boskett's You Told, or Adonio Norwood, and express this over time. Workers acknowledge the difficulties laboring in a factory system with a variety of restrictions and personalities with which to contend. Additionally, African Americans understood they needed to excel and perform better than whites, white employees, to keep their positions within the mill. The company upheld this fear when it decided to publish their comparative work, as I've mentioned. They also compared their turnover rates and attendance rates for all of its mills and published all of this within a newsletter. The pressure to be perfect doing the same jobs with different races and idea of different, and again, not seen as even the same gender at times, comes through as you read each column, with some as addressed as one or addressed properly with proper salutations rather than the others. For example, in April of 1919, Mill No. 2 makes sure to list and report that 96% of their employees had a perfect attendance on a daily rate. And they really wanted to emphasize that they were always there on time, that they were always doing the work that they needed to do. You also see, in fact, the continued reporting of mills over time and how does this industry change. And one of the things I wanted to note, and I'm going to move on from Durham Hosiery, is that, again, you see this changing of how do we see the workers. One of the important things, I think, is also to kind of look up north at this time, a little bit later, to the New Bedford textile strike, and talk about Cape Verdean workers. Because as I've been saying, is that you have black women who are allowed in the mills because they're highly educated within these mills in the North Carolina. Now, these are not the only ones I want to make mention. There are others, they're smaller, but these are the two big examples. In 1928, there's a textile strike in New Bedford, and it includes African women who are Cape Verdean descent. I'm not sure, is anybody familiar with Cape Verdean? A few people are. I'm Cape Verdean. We're mostly in Massachusetts and southeastern Massachusetts, so it's a mixed race culture, right? So it's both African and Portuguese, plus a lot of other things. It is actually, there's no indigenous Cape Verdeans. It was started as a slave colony. There was nobody there. Then Portuguese slavers came in, brought in Africans, and started labor. It didn't work as a plantation colony, but it stayed as a provisioning colony for slaves and also other products throughout from the 1500s on. And so Cape Verdeans start to move to the United States during the early 1900s in full, bigger numbers, later on more in the 1970s, but partly because of the opportunities in the textile mills. The reason I bring them up is that most of the time in the textile industry in the North, you also hear that African American women are not allowed there either. It's interesting, not allowed there either in the North. Yeah. So you have Cape Verdean women who are coming in because they're Portuguese speaking and they look different. So some of them are lighter skinned, some of them are darker skinned, depending on the particular island they're from or the particular family even. And they're working in these textile industries also as semi-skilled workers. And they're also brought into the textile union, which at this point is trying to be much more inclusive of immigrants. But they're not trying to be inclusive of African women. So I find this incredibly interesting given the fact that African American women can't get into this industry, but an ethnic African woman can get into this industry. Also as skilled workers. So, so I've been talking a bit, and I want to give you guys time for comments. My point of all this work, and this again is a broad strokes overview of everything, right? I usually pull out a few pieces, but I really wanted to spend some time talking about it as holistically, is that one of the things I've come away from all this work is to realize that how we view a worker, it depends on a particular place, time, mill, and it's very idiosyncratic to the place. And that we cannot make huge generalizations anymore about who is skilled, who's not skilled, who's considered skilled within a particular place and time. So maybe some might view, well, if you're not doing weaving work as skilled, but doing doffing work or the small work of like hand sewing a sock is, for me, skilled anyway. And so what I'm saying in this piece is that we can no longer take the dominant trope of black women are not being in factories or anything and take it at face value anymore. That we have to kind of go back through the sources and reevaluate them and figure out who's really doing this work. Is this something that's been said over and over again? The reason why I thought there were no black mill workers at all in any of the textile mills was because everybody was quoting somebody from 1921 who said they're incompetent and clumsy and inept and they can't do the work. So I said, well, let's go back through these sources and let's look. I didn't know what I was going to kind of find. I didn't know I was going to spend the next 9 years doing it, but it was actually quite a journey. So I'm going to leave it at that, and thank you for your time this afternoon. So any questions? Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Okay, so interesting stuff.
Thank you.
Let me just hit you with a starting question and then open it up for everyone else. Help us understand these are college-educated women,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Are they married? And if so, who are they married to? So are they in two-income families? Are they also married to college-educated men?
Right.
What's the structure of overall employment in Fayetteville or in Durham in terms of the overall African-American community?
Thank you. That's a great question. It actually really varies. It doesn't seem to matter if they're married or not, if they're in the mill or not. Some of them are a little bit younger, like 18, 19, 20 years old. Some of them are older, like 45 or 50. Some are married or widowed, and some are, you know, and none of their husbands are in the textile industry. And most of their husbands are not wealthy. The one I mentioned, Gertrude Hood, she's not married at the time that she works in a textile mill, but she does get married later she becomes a seamstress after the mill closes, and then she marries somebody 20 years younger than her, which I think is pretty great. he's a tailor. But for black women, being married or not is actually does not preclude you from going into the labor industry. You have to work because your husband is never going to make enough money to really secure and take care of the family. And so you have to be able to make a good living. A lot of these women are also taking in relatives or other people as boarders. And some of those boarders are also working in the mill with them. And I can see that through the census records. So.
Can you fill in a little bit on
sure. Right.
Who were going to a college, what did they expect to get out of the college?
That's a great question.
And would you repeat the question just because it's not being, she's not mic'd and you are.
Okay, so the question was, what are the aspirations of these women who are going off for college education? What do they hope to get out of this? What I see is, well, most black women who are going on to college recognize that there are very limited opportunities with your college education. So they will go into college as going to a normal school and maybe think about being a teacher. But being a teacher is limited opportunity. Not everyone can become a teacher. It's also low pay, and it's incredibly hard work because you are now like the forefront of the community. You're supposed to be taking care of the entire community when you're a teacher. There's a lot on you. And sometimes you're traveling quite far. And it's still a period where if you're married, it's difficult to be a teacher. If you get pregnant, you oftentimes lose your job. So there's not really a lot of opportunity. Some women in Durham actually can work for the Merrick Insurance Company. That's really well known. It's quite big. But not everybody wants to be a secretary and work in that industry as well. Not everybody can. So there's just so few opportunities. I'll use a personal example. My aunt is the first person in my family to get a college degree. She got it in the 1950s. She has in graphic design, but she ended up working in a factory her whole life because she couldn't get a job in design. My dad could as a low-level employee, even though he had a college degree, so he was working in a factory as well. He wasn't doing design work until he went back to college and became a teacher. But that's exactly the same kind of story. This is actually a different kind of job that takes you outside of the home. You don't have to be a teacher. Not everybody can be a nurse. Not everybody has the aptitude for that. So this is one of their opportunities. I don't think this was an aspiration for everybody, but I think what ends up happening is that with Booker T. Washington and Du Bois writing about this in The Crisis and other places, every time they're in the mail, they're written about in The Crisis. Elizabeth City, North Carolina, Ocala, Florida, other places that start to have it. It becomes, well, we're going to try something new. This is kind of innovative. And so in that way, it might look sexy and interesting to them. Like, oh, we're going to be at the forefront of a new movement. So that very well could have been the motivation, given the press coverage. I should note that these mills were mentioned all over the country. New York Times covered them, the Arizona Republican, papers in Sacramento. The whole country knew about these small places that were having 400 or 500 mill workers, but even when they're only 20, they say a new experiment is happening. Charleston, South Carolina, with black workers. Elizabeth City, brand new, they have 40 workers. Or Concord, North Carolina, doing the same thing. So it's really interesting that way.
Okay, do speak up, and hopefully I'll repeat or she'll repeat your question in the back and then up here.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Great question. They're sewing shirts right here. So I think that they're just trying to do something that people can see. So they're sewing in this picture. They're sewing shirts by hand. So they're doing that kind of work. Normally they would do the creation of a sock, so they put a sock on a stand and then weave that or darn it so you can have the sock top. They're also doing silk work, and eventually it changes to parachute work for the war, so eventually that changes. The hourly pay varies. Some people are paid by the piece and some people are paid by the hour. In fact, I have some figures that I didn't mention. They're working about 48 hours a week, and their pay varies. Like $3, I believe, a week. Very, 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 very low pay. And so, let me see if I can find the exact figure. I can't right now. But they're paid very little, and they're paid about two-thirds of what white workers are paid, sometimes even less, and oftentimes paid in piecework. And it had to be perfect to get paid. So it's not even that you did this many pieces, but they had to be absolutely perfect, and then oftentimes they were shortchanged. So the pay wasn't great. It was a little bit better than tobacco work, though, from what I can tell. So.
A little bit better than what?
Tobacco work, which is like, you know, the mainstay, especially in North Carolina.
Yes.
Yes.
I've been trying, and now my second year to work for Cape Verdean worker.
Oh,
now.
Yeah, we'll talk. So, yeah.
I would love to talk to you about sources.
Yes.
Material, especially since it's the same time period.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering then, just looking at the image you used, I'm not sure because as you mentioned, Cape Verdean people range from as dark as me to as light as, you know, any person you think that is Cape Verdean.
Exactly. This happens when I'm teaching too, so it follows me everywhere.
So, how then you're using your sources on Cape Verdean women workers, are you then going to use like how they self-identify? Because I know you're doing a comparison between African Americans and African descended, because
right.
I know there's Portuguese African in the census
right.
All the other weirdo kind of trying to understand. So, are you using some census data that self-identifies them as like African or Black, or are you or mulatto? Because that happens a lot too.
Right. So the question how am I ethnically identifying these women? Am I looking at them holistically as Cape Verdean, or am I looking at how the census enumerates them? Is that correct? Yeah. So I'm actually looking at them holistically, because I think what happens in this period is because there's so many people from Portugal and Azores that the census workers just put on Cape Verdeans their racial marker. And I think that's really less important, the fact that they are still identified as, they're still African, right? So no matter what they look like. And Cape Verdeans, I should be really clear, tend to not say, oh, I'm white or I'm Black. We're just Cape Verdean, right? So we just accept all of it is us, right? So there's no, my brother's much darker than me. So sometimes people are like, oh, you brothers? Yes, we are. But that's how Cape Verdeans look. We look like everything. And so we tend to just include everybody. But what's interesting in this period is that a lot of Cape Verdeans, like my dad, who's now in his 80s, and his father is from Cape Verde, born in 1896, they called themselves just Portuguese because they were Portuguese colony until 1975. So they still saw themselves as Portuguese because they were colonized, not because they didn't see themselves as African or Cape Verdean as an identity. So that will be complicated. I think it's what's particularly interesting, especially with this picture, is that she's clearly Cape Verdean, and she's probably from Fogo or someplace like that, or São Nicolau. She's a little bit darker. She looks like she looks just like my grandmother, which makes me like her a lot. But she is ethnically clearly Black. She's clearly darker skinned. But she's still included in this union when Black women, African women, American women are not included in that. And I think that's what's interesting. It's my beginning of my research on that, but we should definitely talk because, yeah.
Now, could you help us understand the publishing of poetry? You know, that echoes the earlier use of poetry in like the Lowell Offering and other things.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of trade union poetry and worker poetry throughout the 20th century,
right,
up until probably right after World War II. Did they just say, you know, please, we're looking for people to give in poems? Do we know, were they actually asking people specifically, please write poetry?
Right.
Do we know anything about that?
I don't know anything about that specifically, but a lot of African Americans are also writing a lot of poetry in the Crisis magazine and other places, and the Crisis is already out by this point. And so I think it's just part of what's going on. I actually asked my advisor when I was in grad school, and because she works on teachers, she said that's how they also taught a lot of, taught students poetry and how to write poetry in schools. So it was actually really highly emphasized in a lot of the colored schools and also the colleges. So I think they're getting that also from their training as students. So.
Right. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Building off of that, it's interesting you talked about the mill in Fayetteville was built next to a normal school.
Right.
And became Fayetteville State.
Exactly.
I think that's a really
Right. Yeah. The same thing, Durham-Hosterville, I didn't mention it, but they build near the North Carolina Central University, what becomes that, NCCU. And they're always doing that. They're always trying to specifically pick near schools or industrial schools. In Fayetteville State is a really interesting example because they're really purposeful in it. They also tried, I didn't go into it in this because it was just too much, but the Ashley & Bailey company that did that also beforehand tried to do the same thing in Pennsylvania. And had an all-black mill in Pennsylvania for a short time. It burned down or something like that. And they also used some of some money donated to them by a philanthropist to also try to build a school. At least they were trying to. So this is like a normal thing for them to do, which is unlike the Southern-owned mills. They might build it near something, but they weren't making a concerted effort to educate their employees where Fayetteville was. So.
Do we know, by the way, if you actually had at the normal school like flyers were they doing direct recruitment through the normal school?
They were, and we know that through the board minutes of Fayetteville's normal school, that they said that they were specifically trying to train students how to do work in the mills and skilled work in the mills.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other question? Dorothy.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
Yes.
In those mill town states that you mentioned, someone growing up there, would they be as likely as you to do this sort of intensive research on the past history of their mill town?
That's a great question. The question is, if somebody was from the area, from a mill town, would they actually do the research? I'm not sure if they would. I mean, part of the drive was, once I get into a topic.
Have you run into anybody?
No, I mean, I don't, every time I've given this talk or talked about my research, and I've gotten a lot of press interest for this, no one does it. And everybody's surprised. Even, I talked to Jacqueline Dowd Hall actually about it, and she was like, she knew about it, but there hasn't been an expressed interest in doing it. Right.
And they went out on strike. And I asked the speaker then, really, all these cities, and then this African American members, did any of them speak up? And her point was that they were too afraid. And so the question I have is today, your generation.
Right. The question is, if they're afraid like to have these conversations? And I would say yes in some ways. I think also it depends on the topic. So some things are much more readily available, which is why we're gonna have to talk about sources of Cape Verdeans, right? There are some topics that have a lot of sources. This one has sources everywhere, but there's no collection. And you have to be a detective and also willing to spend a lot of time on the topic and know that you're not gonna get the whole story. But I do think that there's a level, I lived in South Carolina for 6 years, and I would say there's definitely a level of fear of talking about certain events and certain things. And you're more willing, most of my classmates were more willing to do topics that seemed a little bit less changing the status quo, let's say. Not because of their fears, but just more because the people they might be interviewing, if they're doing more recent histories, are they willing to talk? And I think maybe part of the reason why we don't have the oral histories for Durham and Fayetteville were people willing to talk openly. They might say, yes, I did this job, but were they willing to talk about what happened and what was work like? Probably not, which is why I like that newsletter, because that way of writing that poetry and just kind of slipping things in and having the letters back and forth gives us a little clue. Even if it might have been edited by the newspaper editors, I don't even think they clearly understood what was being said either, because I think things would not have gone through if they really understood what was being written by these workers.
So you're saying basically that poetry very well may be encoded in its own fashion, in the same way that spirituals were.
Absolutely.
Or other things were, in terms of being much more acceptable as art rather than acceptable as if it had been a political broadside,
right.
It would have been reacted to in a different way.
Exactly. And I think that they use certain language within the pieces, even their letters, to kind of say what they need to say without being so overt that nobody's really going to notice it. It lasts for only the newsletter only lasts for 2 years, but those workers are able to write these things for the entire period and be included. By the way, not segregated out, like all white mills first, colored mills afterwards, they're actually numbered. And so the color number two comes before number three, that's white. And so they're somewhat included in some ways not, but their poetry allows them at least to have a voice, I think. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been able to read it as.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? I guess the only thing I would raise in relation to this whole question of fear is my assumption is that, for example, even if a black man in Fayetteville or Durham is a skilled factory operative, for example,
right.
He never stops being black. So the minute that he doesn't avert his eyes to a white woman on the street, the minute he doesn't step off of the sidewalk, right?
Exactly.
Doesn't matter how skilled he is,
nope.
Suddenly he's simply another black man who's acting up. Right?
Exactly.
So, but let's flip that in relation to your overall, your starting premise in all of this is that we traditionally have not thought of African-American women in this specific kind of labor as skilled labor.
Right.
Right? So, when we think of skilled labor, factory operatives are in an interesting position in terms of what's skilled and what's unskilled.
Right.
So some of the work that you're specifically alluding to, some typologies would have it as unskilled work,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it was machine operative work.
Right.
Loom fixers are regarded as skilled labor. Loom workers are regarded as unskilled.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, I guess, does that problematize this for you in some ways in relation to defining them as skilled labor, or how do you look at that?
Well, I think when I looked at this overall, and this is my argument, is that we have to really kind of change how we define skill. Because most of the time when they say skilled worker, they're talking about white men, and it's because that's the jobs that white men will do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not necessarily more skilled. It's just how they say, okay, we're going to call our work skilled, and we're the only ones who are going to do it.
Right.
No one else is going to be able to do it. So theirs is unskilled or semi-skilled. And I think that's how we really define it. I don't see it. Yes, a loom fixer has to have a highly is skilled, but that doesn't mean the loom worker or the doffer is not as highly skilled. And when you bring in Ashley and Bailey, they're also doing the same work. They're doing the fixing the machines. They're doing the same work within weaving. So they're not doing any different jobs. We're still calling them unskilled or semi-skilled.
Right. So traditionally it was skilled simply because it was white work.
White male in particular, right.
And the minute that it's non-white male work, the question is, do we then turn around and redefine skill, or do we redefine how skilled black men and women are in that
right.
case?
I think we have to think about both. I mean, that's where I'm still really kind of struggling how to like really go through that. Because I do find that those definitions really problematic. I think that we stuck to the definitions that they decided in 1920. We haven't changed them. And I think we need to change those definitions and say, okay, what does this really mean? And why are we even separating it out? Why do we even have to use those terms? Are those terms really relevant? Not even just terms of black women and men, but also women, right? So white women are in mill work too, and they're doing highly skilled work, but they're also called unskilled because then you can pay them less. And that's what the mill workers are doing. The mill owners are saying, we can pay you less. We don't have to give you the same benefits. We can ask more of you this way. So I think that's where we need to kind of like really think about that. And I'm still thinking about that.
Well, great. Well, let's give her a small round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. This is a wonderful thing. And please come back next Monday for Carol Quirk. And thanks again for being part of our Daily Work of Daily Lives.
Thank you.